This episode is supported by Clear Protein. And I've got to say, this one really surprised me. Most protein powders, thick, chalky, and you have to choke them down with some milk. Clear is totally different. It's a whey protein isolate that mixes clear in water. More like a sports drink than a heavy shake. You still get 20 grams of protein per serving with zero sugar, zero lactose, and none of that bloated feeling you get from traditional shakes. The flavors are actually good too. Strawberry watermelon and wild blue raspberry are my go-tos. It's been perfect for after workouts or even just that midday pick-me-up when you don't feel weighted down by food. And because you're a listener, you get 20% off your order, the best discount they offer anywhere. Just head over to Clear Protein and use code ZEROSIGNAL at checkout. That's clear with a K, clearprotein.com, code ZEROSIGNAL.
You're tuned into Zero Signal, a show about what they won't say and what you're probably already thinking. No fluff, no filters, no bullshit. Let's crack it open.
At this time, I'm going to ask you to fasten your seatbelts.
Jenkins, Oakley, Knight.
Jim?
Jim! Don't do it!
Halt! Es nicht bewaffnet! Nein, Otto!
Jim!
My name is Jim.
My name is Otto.
Pleased to meet you, Otto.
Like me.
Rose, she's called.
And soon, I'm soon.
The first thing you notice is the sound, not the guns. It's the fact that they have stopped. Your ears keep bracing for the next crack of a rifle, the next thud of a shell, the next short cutoff scream. And instead, there's just wind moving over broken ground, rattling frozen grass and loose scraps of canvas. Down in the trench, you hear a small sound again, boots scraping damp boards, someone coughing in the dark, the slow drip of melted frost working its way through sandbags. The trench itself creaks and sighs like an old ship in a black ocean. And then from somewhere down the line, through the fog and powder of smoke and winter air, you hear something that does not belong on the battlefield. Singing. One voice at first, thin and a little shaky, then another joins it, then a third. Until in the distance, there's a rough, uneven choir. You don't understand the words at first, but the tune hits you right in the chest. Stille Nacht, Heilige Nacht, Silent Night, Holy Night. You're standing at a trench that smells like wet earth, gunpowder, and sweat soaked deep into wool, nauseating rot of things that have been dead for far too long. It's December 24th, 1914. somewhere along the Western Front. For months, you've been told that the men opposite you are monsters, the Hun, the brutes, the savages, the kind of enemy you can't shoot without ever really letting your brain register the shape of its face. You've watched artillery strip trees bare in an instant, leaving only splintered stumps like broken teeth against the sky. You've seen men you know yesterday become shapes you try not to think about when the trench goes quiet. You can tell outgoing from incoming artillery, the way someone at home can tell rain from hail. And now your enemy is lighting candles and singing Christmas carols. Welcome back to Zero Signal. Tonight, we're going back to a moment in history keeps trying to turn into a cute footnote, a little did you know box in the corner of a page, the Christmas truce of 1914.
As night falls on Christmas Eve, Allied soldiers are surprised by what they are hearing over from the German trenches. Private Frank Sumter is one of the first to recognize what they are singing.
And then we heard the Germans singing Silent Night, Holy Night. Our boy said, let's join in. So we joined in with the song.
The British sentries don't know what to make of what's happening across the narrow no man's land. Private Leslie Walkington was there.
So then we began to pop our heads over the side and jump down quickly in case they shot, but they didn't shoot. And then we saw a German standing up, waving his arms, and we didn't shoot.
When they met on Christmas truce, first they were afraid of each other, and then they started to talk and shaking hands. And once they did that, it just seemed to be friends.
The British khaki and the German grey are soon gathering, all mingled together.
By Christmas 1914, every soldier knew that the enemy was sharing the same misery as they were.
Both sides are well aware that consorting with the enemy is only one step away from treason, a crime punishable by court-martial and execution. Men on both sides go to sleep that night, wondering if they will wake up the next morning to renewed fighting or a continued effort to defy the war. The fear of punishment is enough to get most of the soldiers back to fighting.
How amazingly difficult it must have been for these people to pick up shooting again, and with any kind of vigor, try and kill people in the opposite trench that they just celebrated Christmas with.
Private Archibald Stanley remembers how his officer put an end to their armistice.
Well, if you're knocking around, this fella come up the next day. He said, you still got the armistice.
Picked up his rifle, he shot one of the Germans dead.
On Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, along the stretches of the Western Front, British and German soldiers did something no king ordered, no general planned, and no government wanted. They stopped. They put down their rifles, climbed up out of the earth like ghosts, and walked into one of the places on the map that supposedly belonged to nobody. It was called No Man's Land. Officially, this is treated like a sentimental hiccup, a one-off, a weird little snow globe moment inside the nightmare of World War I. Nice story, but it doesn't mean anything. But if you sit with it and really look at it, it starts to sound a lot more dangerous than that. Because what happened that night is this. The people doing the killing proved for a few hours that they could walk away from their scripts, ignore the propaganda, and recognize each other as human. And the people running the war did not like what it revealed. To see why, we have to rewind a bit. Summer, 1914. The war kicks off with flags and brass bands, politicians giving speech from balconies, crowds packing train stations, cheering young men in new uniforms. We'll show them. You'll be home by Christmas. Mothers and wives wiping tears from their eyes and pretending they're not terrified. By December, those promises are just a bad joke. The Western Front is now a 400-mile wound clawed into the earth, trenches facing trenches, sometimes only a stone's throw apart. Between them, a strip of ground churned into mud and crater and wire. Bodies lying where they fell because anyone who tries to retrieve them gets cut down. No man's land. It's not poetry. It's a practical description. If you walk there when everyone's doing what they're supposed to do, you die. It's as simple as that. Down in the trenches, life is a different flavor of hell. The walls ooze mud. The floor tries to steal your boots. Rats run over your legs while you sleep. Lice chew at your skin. You watch trench foot turn feet into pale, swollen things you don't even want to look at. You fall asleep with your chin on your knees, hip to hip with men who smell exactly like like you do. Your whole world shrinks to this narrow, filthy corridor, a strip of gray sky, and the constant awareness that one shell with bad manners could drop your whole little universe into a crater. It's cold. It's wet. It's very obviously not going to be over by Christmas. Then the calendar rolls into late December, and that word, Christmas, floats up through all the mud and all of the noise. Back home, Christmas is warmth and light, crowded tables, crackling fires, wax dripping from candle stubs and little country churches. Here, it's a metal tin embossed with a royal profile, cigarettes from a princess, chocolate from a Kaiser, a card that says Merry Christmas in careful script handed to a man whose odds of seeing New Year's are basically a coin flip. It's a strange kind of whiplash. With one hand, the machine pats you on the back and gives you treats. The other hand, it points you towards machine guns and tells you to climb. The first sign that something is going to break comes at dusk, and it settles on Christmas Eve. On the German side, little evergreens, scraggly Christmas trees hacked from somewhere behind the lines, start appearing on tops of trenches. Men wedges them into sandbags. Candles flicker on the branches, tiny halos of light around helmeted heads. The Germans start singing hymns, carols, patriotic songs. It's not polished, it's raw and shaky and soft. On the British side, heads peek up, careful and suspicious. You've been taught to hear death and everything. A glint of light, a cough, a patch of silence, a row of candles on the enemy's trench. That could be anything. A trick to draw fire, a distraction. But the bullets don't come. The song grows, the warm glow of candles runs along the Germans' line like someone hung a string of stars on the ground. So the British answer. One voice starts a carol on the Allied side, the First Noel. Another joins in, O come, all ye faithful. Two different languages, but the same songs. The melodies cross over the wire and hang into the frozen air above the corpses. For a minute, the front sounds less like a graveyard and more like a fractured Christmas service. And then a shout rises above all of it, rolled in a German accent in rough English. Tommy, you know shoot, we know shoot. That sentence should not exist here. Once it's been thrown into the darkness, it just hangs there, daring someone to believe it. The truce doesn't happen with a whistle or an official order. It spreads like courage or insanity, or maybe both. In some sections, a single German soldier climbs out first. In others, it's a British soldier. Somewhere, a Scotsman in a kilt scrambles up, his bare knees flashing in the moonlight, and the German burst out laughing because they've never seen anyone go to war with so much leg showing. Imagine taking that first step up a ladder. You've been told that poking your head up for more than a second is basically volunteering to donate your skull to the local sharpshooter. You've listened to bullets crack overhead so often your body flinches before your brain registers the sound. You watch men go over the top and vanish into the smoke, only to be carried back in pieces. Now you're climbing out into the open air with no weapon in your hands. The mud of no man's land grabs at your boots. The ground crunches where it's frozen and squelches where it's not. You move past twisted barbed wire and shattered timber. You see the bodies up close for the first time, the stiff, unnatural angles, the torn wool and frozen fingers. You try not to look too hard at their faces. Opposite you, figures are climbing out of their trenches too. At first, they're just shapes. Then they're men, faces, stubble, teeth flashing at nervous grins, hands raised to show they're empty. You walk towards each other. If this is a trick, this is the most elaborate suicide attempt in history. But the closer you get, the more obvious it is. They're just as scared as you. Somewhere in the middle of the wasteland, you stop. You stick your hand out. A German glove reaches out to grab it. The grip is firm but shaking. You both start laughing because your bodies don't know what else to do with all this energy that was supposed to go into killing each other and suddenly has nowhere to go. Then the floodgates open. Cigarettes appear from every pocket. Pipes, bottle of schnapps, bit of whiskey, chocolate wrapped in greasy paper, sausage. Someone pulls out a photo. Woman in a dress standing in front of a doorway. Kids with ridiculous haircuts. You can't understand everything he's saying, but when he taps the picture and says, Mien Fru, Mien Fru, you know exactly what he means. You dig out your own crumpled snapshots. You show him your wife, your sweetheart, your little brother. He nods like he understands every word you can say. In some sectors, conversation turns practical. They talk about the bodies trapped in the wire, lying face down in the mud for days, swelling and freezing. Men from both armies agree, tonight we will bury them. So British and German soldiers move through no man's land as a single burial party. They lift the dead as carefully as they can, as if the bodies might protest if they're handled too roughly. They dig shallow graves in the frozen earth. They stand in ragged circles, helmets off, heads bowed. An English chaplain reads a prayer. A German chaplain reads one too. The words are different. The ache underneath is the same. Here in this strip of land meant only for dying, they hold the only honest funeral these men will ever see. And somewhere in all this, a ball appears. Not a perfect stadium ball, just a scuffed up lump of leather one of the men has been hoarding like a treasure. It hits the ground, and a dozen soldiers, German, British, Scottish, chase it without waiting for anyone to declare sides. Long coats fly open as they run. Boots skid and slide. Someone yells a curse in German that makes everyone laugh. A big German defender shoulders a British private aside and then, grinning, hauls him back to his feet. The shot goes so wildly off target that both trenches roar with laughter. For a few 2 minutes, the only thing flying through the air between the lines is that ball, not bullets. If you're in that mud, in that moment, it feels like the world is cracked and something bright is pouring through the split. If you're sitting at a desk miles away reading a report that your frontline troops have climbed out of their fortifications, walked into no man's land, shaked hands with the enemy, and played football, it feels like a threat, not from the Germans or the British, but from your own men. Because if they can just decide not to shoot today, what happens if they decide not to shoot tomorrow or the day after? The Christmas truce wasn't planned. It wasn't approved. It completely broke the rules of the game. So the people who wrote the rules reacted fast. On both sides, orders calmed down. No more fraternizing with the enemy. No more climbing out of the trenches except to attack. No more sharing cigarettes. No more swiping badges. No more joint burials. No more shouted greetings. In some places, they start using the word treason. Think about that. Talking to the man in the opposite trench, treason. Helping bury a body that's been rotting between your lines, treason. Realizing the beast you've been ordered to kill has a wallet full of family photos just like you, treason. From the point of view of the war machine, mercy is a security breach. It's one thing for generals to play at peace in conferences. They can control that. It's quite another thing when frozen, terrified, exhausted men at the bottom of the ladder start creating their own ceasefire in the middle of the night. The truth is a glitch in the system. The fix? Tighten discipline. Crack down on letters home that tell the wrong kind of a story. Turn up the volume on propaganda. Hammer home again and again that the other side is not like you, not human the way you are, not worth the same grief, the same tears, the same prayers. Over time, the official story of war quietly pushes the truce into the background. When it is remembered, it is softened. Isn't that nice? Those chaps had a little football match in the middle of a war. People are basically good after all. Anyway, back to the big battles and the heroic charges. What gets sanded off is the sharp edge. The fact that thousands of men proved in real time that the war only worked as long as they all agreed to keep doing it. After 1940, there's no second Christmas like this. The war eats that memory and keeps marching. More shells, more gas, more bullets, more names carved into stone. The system has seen what happens when soldiers look each other in the eye, and it doesn't intend to let it happen again. So what do we do with that? Where's the conspiracy here? It's not one evil mastermind stroking a cat in a dark room. Something much more subtle. A network of decisions, big and small, that all point in the same direction. Keep the war going, keep the machinery running, and bury anything that might remind people they could refuse. What scares the war machine isn't the enemy guns, it's empathy, recognition, that quiet, dangerous moment when a man in one uniform looks at a man in another uniform and thinks, if I had been born in your town instead of mine, I might be wearing the same coat as you. The Christmas truce is one long, luminous moment of recognition, and that's why it gets turned into a postcard instead of a warning sign. Now fast forward to right now. We live in a world with more information and more connection than those men in the trenches could have ever dreamed of. We don't need to risk our lives climbing out of the trench to see the faces of the other side. We can see them on our phones, families sheltering in basements, kids in makeshift classrooms, soldiers, warriors filming themselves between attacks. You think that would make it harder to dehumanize people? But the logic of the system hasn't changed much. It just upgraded its tools. The minute a war starts, the narrative hardens. The labels roll out. Evil, terrorist, Nazi, orc, scum. Wars designed to smear whole groups of people into one ugly, faceless thing. Wars designed to make sure you never let your heart relax enough to wonder what they're afraid of or who they miss. Algorithms amplify the loudest, angriest voices. Peace sounds like weakness. Nuance sounds like betrayal. And yet, under all that, the same old dangerous truth is still there. If we see each other clearly, it gets harder to keep killing each other. Now I want to turn a corner. Because all of this, the truce, the candles on the trench lines, the carols drifting over no man's land, happens on Christmas. I'm not just a conspiracy guy, I'm also a Christian. So I can't tell this story without talking about Christ. Because at the center of Christmas is another story, one so familiar we can almost recite it without thinking, which is exactly why it slips past us. A young woman, pregnant before the wedding completes, a confused fiance trying to trust what he's been told in a dream, a long forced trip because some emperor far away wants everyone counted and taxed, no room, no guest room, just a place with animals and straw, the Son of God. You take this story seriously. God enters the world not as a general, not as a king, not as a billionaire, but as a crying helpless baby, born into poverty, born under occupation, laid in a feeding trough. The first people who hear about him aren't governors or priests, they're shepherds, men on the edges of society, working the night shift. They're the ones the angels tell a savior is born, peace on earth. From the very beginning, the Christian story is about God stepping into the dirt, into danger, into what we would call no man's land, the place where suffering and fear and injustice pile up. Fast forward 30 plus years, and that same child, grown into a man, is hanging on a Roman cross, naked, bleeding, between two criminals. He talks about loving enemies, not just neighbors. He says things like, "Blessed are the peacemakers, and if someone strikes you on the cheek, turn the other." He tells his followers to pray for those who persecute him. He forgives the people killing him when they're still doing it. From the world's perspective, this is complete insanity. From a Christian perspective, this is God's logic written in blood. Now, what does this have to do with the trenches of 1914, with Ukraine and Russia in 2025, with you listening to this episode? It's this. Christians believe that at the cross, Jesus stepped into the ultimate no man's land, between a holy God and a rebellious humanity, between people and their enemies, between every dividing wall we build, and let all that hatred, all that violence, all that sin crash onto him. He simply absorbed it, and then he rose again, not just to say, "Look, miracles are real," but to open up a new way of being human, a way where reconciliation isn't a naive fantasy. It's a natural fruit of knowing you've been forgiven. The Christmas truce is like a small flickering picture of that. In the middle of a world organized around hatred and fear, light leaks through. A few candles, a few carols, a few empty hands extended in risk and trembling. For a night, the men in the trenches live as if Jesus was serious when he said, "Love your enemies." They don't have the theology sorted out. They're not angels. They'll go back to fighting. But for those hours, they're living closer to the kingdom of God than all the dignitaries giving speeches in warm buildings miles away. So now I want to speak directly as a Christian to a very particular no man's land, to Ukraine. To Russia. Somehow, someday, a soldier in a trench near one of the Ukrainian towns, or a conscript sitting in a dugout near Belgrade, or a mother hiding with her kids in a basement in Kharkiv, ever hear these words? This is for you. You have been given so many names for each other. Nazi, orc, fascist, terrorist, aggressor, collaborator. You've been told again and again that the people on the other side are monsters, that their lives are worthless, that their deaths count more as wins than as tragedies. You've been told that God is on your side and not on theirs, that he blesses your bullets more than theirs. But the Jesus I follow is not a tribal mascot. He doesn't belong to one flag. He was born under occupation. He lived among ordinary people pushed around by empires. He healed the servant of an enemy officer. He told the story where the good guy was from a hated group. He died forgiving forgiveness. He died praying forgiveness over the men who hammered the nails. So hear this from one Christian voice, far away, but trying to be honest. Jesus loves the people in the other trench as much as he loves you. He shed the same blood for them that he shed for you. He hears Russian prayers and Ukrainian prayers. He weeps over Russian widows and Ukrainian widows. He listens to the terrified breath of soldiers on both sides who whisper, "Lord, have mercy," even if they're not sure who they're talking to. I'm not here to tell you what orders to follow or disobey. I don't know your life, your risk, the pressures crushing you. I will not sit in safety and say, "Just put your guns down and walk away." Like, this isn't a choice that could cost you everything, including your life. But as a Christian, I can say this. Your soul is not state property. Your heart does not belong to any president or general or party. Belongs to God only. And in Christ, you are allowed, commanded even, to see your enemy as someone you could one day call brother or sister. You are allowed to pray for them. You are allowed to ask God to protect their children and yours. You are allowed to refuse inside your own chest to let hatred finish its work in you. Maybe you'll never get a Christmas truce. Maybe the drones and the artillery and the orders are too constant, too heavy. Maybe climbing out into whatever passes for no man's land where you are would be suicide. There's still a place where a truce can begin, and that's in your heart. If you belong to Christ, then the same spirit who raised him from the dead lives in you. That spirit can do strange things, unnatural things, things the war machine is terrified of. He can help you forgive. He can help you refuse to see people as less than human. He can help you pray for your enemies through clenched teeth and wet eyes. He can keep you from becoming what this war is trying to turn you into. So to the Ukrainian soldiers listening in the dark, checking your phone between incoming rounds, Christ is with you in that hole. He sees your fear. He knows you're exhausted. He knows you're angry. He doesn't despise any of that. He has stood in the garden sweating blood and saying, "Father, if there is any other way," he understands. To the Russian conscript who didn't want to be here, who feels used, who feels trapped between fear and dying and fear of refusing, Christ is also with you. Not as a stamp of approval in every command you receive, but as the one who knows what it is to stand before corrupt power and stay truthful. He was beaten by soldiers too. He knows that uniform doesn't tell your whole story. To the mothers and fathers in both countries, lying awake and staring at the ceiling, replaying last words, and worrying over quiet phones. The God who watched his own son die is not indifferent to your grief, and he is not far. My prayer for you, for Ukrainian and for Russians, is not a cheap thoughts and prayers line. It is that the Spirit of Christ would protect your humanity in a place designed to destroy it. That he would open ways of peace that no one else can see right now. That he would raise up brave voices and quiet acts that push back against this terrible war. And if you are a follower of Jesus on either side of that front, I want to remind you directly, your first flag is the cross. Long after these borders are redrawn and these leaders are gone and these headlines are history, Christ will still be king. He will stand side by side with believers from the other side in a kingdom where nobody remembers where the old trenches used to be. So don't let this war write your theology. Let Jesus do that. Let him teach you how to carry a cross even while you're forced to carry a rifle. Let him teach you how to long for justice without losing mercy. Let him teach you how to look across your own no man's land and see a person for whom he died. As we land this episode, I want you, wherever you are, to hold on to one image in your mind. A dark, ruined field. The sky above it scarred by old shell fire. Candles flickering along the edges of two trenches. Men climbing out of the earth with trembling legs and empty hands. German, British, Scottish. Walking towards each other across ground that has only ever known death. In the middle, they meet. Not as heroes, not as saints, just as men who, for one night, dared to believe that the message sung in those carols might be more than just words. The God of everything, the God we call Christ, the Holy Redeemer. I believe that night he was not in the palaces or the war room. He was out there in no man's land, standing by the bodies being finally buried, standing by the soldier who couldn't bring himself to aim low the next day, standing by the ones who said brother in a language they barely spoke. And today I believe he is still in no man's land, all over this world. Between nations, between neighbors, between husbands, between wives who haven't spoken kindly in months, between churches split over lesser things than life and death. That's where Jesus goes, into that gap, into the place everyone else has written off as hopeless. He steps in and stretches out his arms on a cross in a trench in a living room and says, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you, not as the world gives." So wherever you are, whoever you are, may you know that peace. May you know that peace. May you meet Christ in your own no man's land. And may you, in his strength, dare to see an enemy, and even if only in your heart for now, whisper the most dangerous words in any war, brother. This is Zero Signal. I wish everyone listening and all of our loyal fans a Merry Christmas. In the name of Jesus, the Prince of Peace, may God have mercy on Ukraine. May God have mercy on the Russian soldiers. May this new year that is quickly approaching find true peace. May he teach all of us how to live like the truce he began at the cross is more than just a story. How those soldiers in 1940 demonstrated it to everyone in the world. And hopefully one day soon, we can pit down our rifles and treat each other with kindness and love.
We've hit the 0 hour. That's a wrap on this week's transmission. New episodes drop weekly, so stay tuned and don't miss the next signal. Follow, subscribe, and spread the word. You've been listening to Zero Signal. We're out.